Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie, your host, coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. That's B-A-M. I can also be found easily on Twitter, @Brother_Andre, and on Facebook. Tonight's show is on distributism, answering objections. And it is therefore a follow-up from last week's show on distributism, economics as if God and the family matter. My guest once more is Mr. John Sharp, the co-founder and managing director of IHS Press. In fact, John will join me for the first as well as the second segments of the show. Usually it's the second segment where I have a guest, but we're going to spend the whole show, basically, except my little four-minute or so coda at the end, the third segment. We're going to spend the whole time with John because there's a lot of ground to cover, because there are a lot of objections to distributism, and we want to make sure we want to give some airtime to those objections and to John's replies to those objections. By the way, I'm going to be doing the objecting or the asking, and he's going to be doing all of the answers to those objections. So without any further ado, joining me now via Skype is Mr. John Sharp. Good evening, John.
Hello, brother. Thank you for having me back. You're a brave soul to subject yourself to another installment.
Well, I guess I could say the same for you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I wanted to start off by making a because people who may have heard the show last week who'd never heard of distributism may have started like Googling it and found out things like, well, John Sharp's a communist and a Nazi all at the same time.
Right.
They may have also found out that distributism is somehow just a sort of warmed over Christian socialism. They may have found out that it claims that Chesterton and Belloc, who were some of the principal distributists, had no clue what they were talking about regarding economic matters, because economics is, after all, a science, and they didn't have the sort of the scientific habitus to be writing about these subjects. There's a lot that they're going to find on the internet by Catholics as well as by non-Catholics about distributism. Most of it, I think, is by capitalists saying that distributism is essentially a repackaged form of socialism. Now, I found a gentleman's website. It's called Practical Distributism, and the name of the gentleman is David W. Cooney. I don't know if you know him or know of his work, but I was reading something that he wrote, and I found a great quote that I think is apt to begin our discussion. He says this: distributists make many of the same criticisms against capitalism as the socialists, but we also make many of the same criticisms against socialism as the capitalists. I'm saying that because there's a lot of confusion, because when a distributist talks, a person might think, oh, he's a socialist, or might think, oh, he's a capitalist, because when he's criticizing the other form, when he's criticizing socialists, he might sound like a capitalist. When he's criticizing capitalists, he might sound like a socialist. Fair enough, John? I mean,
and brother, you're the philosopher of the two of us, and it seems to me a typical fallacy to assume that because one is objecting to principle X, one can't deduce from that one particularly advocates anything within the confines of that statement other than opposition to principle X. It's like saying, I don't believe in using baseball bats to beat small children, therefore I'm an antagonist to all baseball bats and I refuse to use them when I play baseball. I mean, it's a fallacy, right? Any number of different fallacies implicated in that.
Sure, but in political matters, we're sort of programmed, and this is, I realize this is an economic matter, but politics clearly enters in. And in political matters, we are programmed to think in terms of black and white or red and blue, as the case may be.
Well, exactly, and this is why the as we get into the objections and whatnot, according to some of the correspondence you and I have had separately, it's a whole question of ideology and worldview, and distributism as one small slice of church social teaching really is just one of many battlegrounds in terms of this whole idea of the liberal slash modern experiment, which involves all kinds of contradictions to which the church and Catholic culture and history have the only answers as far as we're concerned. I hope I can say we. Obviously.
Okay, so on to our first question. How would you reply to the objection that distributism is socialism? And I don't mean some sort of redefined socialism, because I do know that the word had something of a fluid meaning, especially around the time of Chesterton and Belloc. But rather, how can you get out? How can you say? How can you argue against its being the socialism that was condemned by Pope Pius XI?
Well, to put it in context, I mean, the thinkers of that period. I'm thinking of just one example, one of numerous examples. There was a German Jesuit, obviously a scholar, academic, Catholic mind. Victor Kathrein, it's Kathrein. So the German speakers in the among your listeners would obviously correct my pronunciation, but you can look him up in the Catholic Encyclopedia from around the turn of the century as a contributor on economic subjects, and he has a long book dedicated solely to the subject of socialism, which, according to some of the commentaries on that volume when it came out. He was praised by his socialist antagonists for his fairness, because they said, well, obviously we don't agree with your conclusions and your ultimate rejection of socialism, but you have you've stated our position fairly and accurately, and we can't complain. And what he says in that volume, and this is the standard position, remember, this is now it's turn of the century, so it's about 30 years before Pius XI's famous condemnation of socialism. You know, the remark that runs on the top of the Wanderer, right? No Catholic can be a Catholic and a socialist at the same time.
Yes, yes.
But Kathrein says that socialism, not just the essence as if there's some other kind of socialism, but intrinsically and essentially and necessarily, socialism is and only is a doctrinaire or a principled denial of the right of any private individuals, whether a person, let's use the term person, because that really covers an individual, a single human being, or a corporate body, so a large corporation or a group of three or four people, what have you.
Which would be a moral person.
Right, you got it. A moral, so let's say a moral or a real person, an individual, human individual. The doctrinaire principled denial of the right of any of those persons to own productive property. Privately owned productive property. You have, in order to be guilty of the sin, or let's say the doctrinal philosophical error of socialism, you have to deny at its root that private ownership of productive property is legitimate.
Okay, and distributism, since it obviously wants the widest possible distribution of productive property, is utterly inimical to that.
Well, it's a bit difficult. I mean, you tell me how anyone can say that it even remotely smacks of socialism, and hopefully we'll get on later with an opportunity to talk about how it's the only alternative to socialism.
Mm-hmm. Once again, to reiterate, because socialism utterly rejects the the ownership of productive property by persons, moral persons or real persons, as the case may be, and advocates for state ownership of that instead.
Yeah, and brother, let me just cut you off, because the question of what socialists propose as who the owner is it varies from one school to the next. So that I would just respectfully say, It let's not even talk about who they advocate should be the owner. The point is that they deny the right of ownership to any private person.
Okay, so since and at that at on that point, which is the essence of socialism, since that's the essence of socialism, then socialism and distributism, which distributism advocates the widest possible distribution of privately owned productive property, they are radically opposed at their most fundamental levels, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's very interesting, because, you know, a lot of the problem with the commentary, the running commentary on the internet, is that some of our armchair, say, economic philosophers don't really do their homework. To study this whole phenomenon, you have to know Marx very well. You have to know Engels. You have to know LaSalle. You have to know What is it that's being talked about? I mean, I would say I'm even a historicist when it comes to the encyclicals, because you have a pope condemning a certain error, but unless you understand what that error is and what angle the pope was taking in condemning it, you can very easily blow out of proportion, you know, an individual papal statement. The context is key to everything. I don't think that makes me a situation ethicist, but it's just reality, right? The way things work historically. So Marx himself had no objection to capitalists, because Marx felt that the inherent grinding into the dust of the proletarian workers would automatically provoke this revolution, which he envisioned would usher in the dictatorship of the proletariat. And we all know the phrases and the buzzwords within that Marxist tradition. But the only people he really hated were the peasants, who insisted on being their own proprietors of their own property and applying their own labor to their own property to meet their own material needs, because he thought they were an obstacle to the entire progress towards paradise that he was expecting. And Marx is absolutely full of venom for the peasants, for the small proprietors, because they get in the way of his plans. He has no concern at all about capitalism. In fact, he's a huge fan of it.
He's a fan of it as a means to achieving his end, right?
Right. That's right. That's right. And I think we'll, again, if we follow the questions that we exchanged notes about, the other point to bear in mind, and particularly Fulton Sheen in his 1948 book, Communism and the Conscience of the West, but it's all over other places and it's found in many, many other authors. He's a good example. However, he talks about how even practically speaking, the idea of this workers' paradise, this dictatorship of the proletariat, that is a coming to fruition of the aims and the dreams of capitalists. If capitalists envision, or if the, say, the goal of a state in which capitalism is enshrined as the chief philosophy and the chief guiding vision in the state, the goal, of course, is to maximize production and just make as much stuff as you possibly can, most efficiently, most quickly, most cheaply, as many gadgets as possible with the minimal investment. Well, the communists, at least the sincere ones, and I hope you're not going to cut me off, there were sincere ones, said, well, if that's what we're after, we can do it better. Now, practically, I don't dispute that it's a failure. It was a failure, saying that by centralizing production, and now we come into the question of state ownership and state management. But none of them advocated control of production by the state, because they thought it would be less efficient or less productive or less successful. I mean, it's just contrary to, you know, it defies common sense, but also history.
Yeah, They didn't say, let's do this because it's going to be bad.
No, of course not. They just wanted, Fanfani, for instance, the other book maybe we mentioned last time, he just calls it state capitalism. He says communism is state capitalism, which is what it is. It's control of production and the means of production, the capital or the plant, if you will, these economic terms, by a centralized authority, because they think that they can make more stuff more effectively, more quickly, more cheaply. And that's exactly what every capitalist is aiming for.
Okay. Well, now you've done a good job showing us that the words have to be looked at in context, and what, for instance, what socialism meant at the time of its condemnation by Pius XI, and what these phrases actually mean in their context is important. Could you define for us, now we're talking about, we're throwing around these words, capitalism, socialism, distributism. Could you give us good, reliable working definitions, and I don't mean your own, but definitions that people are going to generally accept for these three different economic systems?
Well, we've covered socialism, right? And this is, and I will only balk slightly at your people will generally accept caveat, because I certainly can't guarantee that. And my experience is that people don't accept them, because I'll give you the example of capitalism. My definition, based on, you know, research and exposure to all of the different sources, both pro, con, and indifferent, includes as one of the essential elements of capitalism the idea of unrestrained economic competition between private persons. And as we said before, person means individual just as well as moral person, i.e. IBM or Apple or Lockheed is one moral person in this conversation. That's a fiercely contested point. I had an argument in the pages of Latin Mass magazine 15 years ago where I was trying to make the point that if you take unrestrained competition out of the definition of capitalism, it's no longer capitalism. Most of what I've read, I could cite you a million sources that probably waste everyone's time, confirms that view, but that is a contested point because it's not a favorable point for capitalists. They don't like to admit that capitalism not only permits but encourages as an intrinsic element the setting up on the same playing field of the small man who's trying to run a general store in a small town and Walmart that comes in or any big box store that comes in and flattens him just because of the inherent advantages that those enterprises have, you know, on the playing field. But if once you start regulating capitalism, it's not really capitalism anymore.
Okay. So, then what is it when you start regulating it?
Well, then it starts. If you put it, let's say you are on a continuum.
Is it Keynesian? Is it Keynesianism?
Let's look at private property. Let's make private property the hub of this. A distributed says that private ownership, and let's just as a caveat for the three things. Let's say when we talk about private property, we're talking about productive property. And if it's, you tell me if it's worth saying what that is. But I think between the two of us, it's understood.
Productive property, a farm, I can grow things on it, or a shop, I can fix things and charge for my labor.
And to go slightly technical for a minute, it's property that is not used directly for consumption. It's property that generates other wealth to meet primary needs. So a spoon, for instance, if that's all you have to dig a small hole to drop some seeds in, the spoon is productive property at that point. If you're using it to eat a bowl of soup, it's pretty much, even though you're not going to eat the spoon, it's pretty much property for consumption because you're just using it to meet needs. You're not using it to create wealth that meets needs. That makes sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So when we talk property in terms of these three isms, we're always talking about productive property because the communists, they had napkins and they had silverware and they had plates and they had, you know, all kinds of things that you just use to live, right? We're talking about things that generate. And the classic example for Marx is the factory because it involves lots of machines and buildings and all of the infrastructure that goes into making one of these enterprises work. And you don't consume any of that. That's all equipment that's used to make wealth. So okay. I've got to shut off this buzzer here in the background. I apologize.
That's right.
We'll put it on a continuum and we talk about the Keynesianism and all that. The distributist says the smallest viable unit that can own its own productive property to which it applies its own labor for meeting that unit's needs is a good. That's what distributism aims for. We can argue later if there's more objections as to whether that's really good or not, but we have to beg that question for the moment because that's what the distributist assumes is good.
Okay, repeat that, please. Repeat it.
Yeah, it's the smallest, say, reasonable, feasible economic unit owning the productive property to which it applies its own labor in order to meet its own immediate needs. That schema setup, if you will, is a good that is pursued by the distributist ideal.
So that's all clothed in rather abstract language, but concretely you're talking about the family.
Well, I am, because we say that the smallest economic unit is, we have to start with the Greeks like we talked about last time, that again is assumed as the first building block of the state is the family. But it's intentionally put in abstract language because there are certain economic endeavors that can't be done by the family, right? So no one would suggest, well, we need to have families building their own satellites or space shuttles. It obviously involves subsidiarity, but I don't talk too much about subsidiarity because it's kind of used as a buzzword. Oh, we believe in that. Well, what does that mean exactly? What it means is that if the family can do something for itself economically, it should. But not only should it, just because somebody who came up with the term subsidiarity says so, but because the idea of a family controlling the means whereby it generates its own wealth that's considered a good in the distributist vision. And I can defend, you know, where that came from. I don't want to get off the subject now. Looking at this continuum of private ownership, private control of productive property, the capitalist is in favor of that, but the capitalist doesn't want to run up against any limitations on what his increasing and expanding control of private productive property does to anyone else in his social world. So you look at the man who owns the general store compared to the man who manages the Walmart. The man who owns the general store, if he's operating with a Catholic Aristotelian traditional vision, says, I enjoy my work. I engage in my work because I'm supposed to. You know, after the fall of Adam, we're supposed to earn our bread in the sweat of our brows, but also just to meet the needs of myself and my immediate family. And it doesn't mean I'm only talking food, clothing, and shelter, but those are primary. And then everything else is added on to that according to my state in life. So in the old days, an aristocrat is going to live a much more elaborate and elegant lifestyle than a peasant. And that's, you know, part of the hierarchy that we all believe in. But at the end of the day, there is an inherent limit to what the man who runs the general store needs, because he's trying to meet the needs of himself and his family for whatever they need to live according to their state of life. On this continuum of private ownership of productive property, as we alluded to a little bit last time, the capitalist vision, and I don't want to point fingers at individual capitalists, but let's say the vision, as far as I'm concerned, an essential element of the capitalist vision is, if I can buy a second store and then a third store, or open one, forget buying it, if I can open a second store and a third store and a fourth store and a fifth store, so that the amount of revenue and income that's coming into my own pocket increases, and I can buy another house and maybe a yacht and maybe spend 8 months out of the year in Tahiti, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why not? There's no limit. And of course, you know the distinction Thomas makes between artificial and real wealth, artificial or what's called token wealth. It's just money. And there's really, once you get an attachment to money, there's no limit. If you have $1 million in the bank, you think, well, that's okay, but two would be better. I'd actually be more comfortable with 10 or 50 or 100 or 3 billion or what have you.
And of course, at the upper extreme of that continuum is your Walmart or your Amazon.com, or and you see it like the old cartoon of the bigger fish eating the smaller fish, and the bigger fish eating the bigger fish, and so on.
Right.
You see when the online places came into existence, then the gigantic box stores you talked about before started getting serious competition, and then they had, so they're all trying to gobble each other up, and meanwhile they're all gobbling up all the little minnows, which is the mom and pop stores.
Right, and the Republican slash conservative slash neocon whatever objection to this train of this potentially treasonous or subversive line of discussion is, well, show me anywhere in Catholic theology slash moral philosophy, whatever, that says here's a particular limit on how much I can own. Well, you're not going to find one, because that's not the point. Because the point isn't so much that someone owns 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 shops, but the point is that at what point does that range or that scope of ownership start to impede the ability of, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Joe, mom and pop, to run their own concern. But again, that's why I emphasize that when you start on this continuum with distributism, you have to believe, if you say you're a distributist, or if you're trying to figure out what the essence of it is, you have to believe that mom and pop running their own shop is intrinsically a good, and it is better for them to run their own shop than it is for the competition to have 3 or 4 or 5 or 15 yachts.
Or it's better
if you don't accept that as a premise. Go ahead.
It's better for them to run their own shop than to be the employees of a bigger corporation that owns several.
Right. And which isn't to say there's anything wrong with being an employee, but the real issue comes down to the argument on the Walmart side is, well, it's more efficient. There's distribution networks, there's economies of scale. I mean, I can move millions of pieces of Tupperware around the country by sitting at a shipping terminal. I mean, isn't this great? And the mom-and-pop shop may say, well, look, we don't carry that. I mean, if you want some dishes, here's what we have, right? I mean, either take them or not. So no real distributist should or would ever argue we can out consumerize the big box stores, because that's not what it's about.
It's a question of ideology.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's a question of what price do you put on, to speak, with an economic metaphor, what price do you put on the independence that attaches to a family that controls its own destiny, even though there's a great chance, especially today, that they're going to be working harder, they're going to be working longer hours, surely more disadvantages. They may even be operating without these insurance networks and safety nets, because I don't know if you've looked into health insurance kind of thing on your own. I've lost touch of what the whole Obama insurance scheme has done, but I know even for our small press, which is an employee-free enterprise, just trying to figure out the insurance thing was this complete nightmare. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I was employed by a employer before, it's just part of the package, insurance, dental, medical, whatever. You don't even really think about it. It's This is a key question about what is the moral good, and is it worth accepting certain inconveniences, disadvantages, et cetera, in exchange for that good? And if you say, well, look, I'd rather honestly be a kind of well taken care of wage earner than an independent owner. I mean, certainly there are people like that in the world, and they have a place to go. And there's things in the middle scale where there's medium sized concerns that don't have thousands and thousands of stores. And so that's a wide range. It's not a one size fits all kind of thing. But
John,
but
we're going to have to go to a break. OK.
Yeah,
and we can pick that up when we get back after the
no
break.
No problem.
This is Brother Andre. My guest is John Sharp. You're listening to Reconquest on the Veritas Radio Network. Please stay around after the break.
You're listening to Reconquest with Brother Andre Marie, seeking that which was lost and fighting for it, exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.